Okay, we're going to back up a little bit. There was one Sunday that we went through some Old Testament sites. We started at the north of Israel and the city of Dan. We came down through Hazor and then Megiddo, and we ended up at Lachish. And there's been some news this week. How many have heard any news about Lachish this week? Yeah, okay, one. So the news comes out, it seems to be, now that I'm paying a little bit more attention, about every other week there's something that happens over there in Israel. There's a discovery made of some sort, and it continues to confirm the Old Testament accounts, New Testament accounts of Scripture. And so the one that was out this week was all about Lachish, and this is a picture that I showed as I was going through Lachish. As you remember, that it's a fortified city, one of the major fortified cities south of Jerusalem. And typical of a city, it had one gate to go into the city. And what you see there is some excavation happening by the Israeli Antiquities Authority. Any excavation that happens, of course, they have to be a part of it. So that's the Israeli flag and the IAA flag. And we had an opportunity just to stop, talk with them. They were telling us what they were doing. And what they were doing here is, as you remember, Lachish was put under siege by the Assyrians. They built a siege ramp up on top, up to the gates. Not the gates, I'm sorry, the gates are over here. Up to the wall. And the Jews built another ramp up to that, so they had to continually build up. But eventually the Assyrians were victorious. And the town was destroyed. It was rebuilt at least once or twice, but never to the same magnitude. But anyhow, this was the gate. The outside of the gate had already been exposed a number of years ago, excavated, and they found lots of artifacts there. So when we were there last Christmas into January, they had begun excavation on the interior side of the gate. Remember I said these gates are... many times they have towers associated with them, chambers. This is where places of business occur because this is where the flow of traffic was in and out of the city. So court cases were heard, business was done, the leaders of the town did business there, and so they wanted to see what they could find there. And what they found, okay, here is an aerial view of it being having been excavated after we were gone. And you see these a typical six-chambered gate on the inside. And what's really interesting is that in one of these chambers, okay, here's a picture of what the town might have looked like. Very interesting. This is the normal entryway. And they built it going up this direction because as people would have come in to attack, they would have held their shields to the left and there would have been exposed on the right. So isn't that interesting how they built so that they would be exposed? This is that glisse, I think that's how you pronounce it, something like that. The word means ice, but that's the town or the soldiers, the military would have packed this down, and when it became wet, it was just like ice. So any attacking military would... they'd have to come over this initial wall here, but when they got here, they had no footing before they got there. So, and that was the major large fortress in the center of the town, and this was the gate system. You had to come up this ramp and then make a right turn, and you went past these towers. And then here inside, you see, this is where a lot of the business would have been conducted in the town, for the town. And so inside, it's a little bit what... this might have looked like again. Oops. So there were many chambered. They would have had a roof on it. There would be the wooden gate, actually. They might have had a second floor and then where they could defend, just to give you an idea. And this is one thing they found in here. It was a shrine to the pagan gods. So as you remember, before Israel was carried away, they disobeyed God. They continued to worship idols and the gods of the people that they conquered. No different down here in Lachish. They had continued to have these high places and worship places to Baal, Asherah, poles, things like that. And inside they found one of these shrines to the pagan gods, and this would have been the stone that held or was the altar, and it would have had four horns on the end, which would have been typical pagan worship. And here you can see the gentleman pointing to where they would have broken these horns off. So just let me read you a little bit of a passage. This may have happened during the reign of King Hezekiah, which is recorded for us in 2 Kings chapter 18. In the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 29 years. His mother's name was Abijah, daughter of Zechariah. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father David had done. And this was unusual now for the kings. He removed the high places, smashed the sacred stones, and cut down the Asherah poles. He broke into pieces the bronze snake Moses had made, for up to that time the Israelites had been burning incense to it. And so it's recorded that when Hezekiah, king of Judah, he would have reigned in Jerusalem, the next most powerful city would have been Lachish, to the south of it. In fact, when armies came in to evade, the Assyrians did this. They would hit Lachish first, because that was a very fortified city, a backup city military-wise for Jerusalem. So they would try to conquer that first before they went to Jerusalem, exactly what Assyria did. But Hezekiah would have gone down to Lachish, a very important town, and here we have evidence where he destroyed the high places. And what's also interesting is in that chamber of the shrine to these foreign gods, they had built a limestone commode and installed it there. Now, it's recorded earlier in the book of Kings when Jehu did the same thing. He destroyed the high places and went around. And what he did, it's recorded, is that he turned these shrines into latrines. And so I'm thinking, and what the thought is, Hezekiah did the same thing when he destroyed that. And this is what they found. Found a limestone commode, you might say. Now, they did testing on this and underneath, and it was never actually used, so it was symbolic. But this was defiling forever on the high place of worship for these foreign gods. So this is evidence. And I just thought that was very, very interesting that this is the work that they were doing while we were there. And also they found, to link it to Hezekiah, some pottery. And these are pottery handles, and that symbol there is Hezekiah's seal. So his seal was there. So obviously he reigned, and his evidence is there. I thought I had one more picture. I guess not. All right, so we'll stop there. So that's a little bit of current events as it relates to our story so far in Lachish. And so I just encourage you to keep your eye out for things that are happening, the news and things and discoveries that are taking place over there in Israel. Okay, so we'll move up a little bit. I need to finish just a little bit of last week's. I failed to ask you a question at the end of the notes. You might have seen there was a question on there. Why is there, because we talked about Herod, introduced this idea of Herod playing a huge role in the context of New Testament Israel, especially at the time of Christ. Of course, the very first introduction that we have in the scripture in the New Testament is Herod and the massacre of the innocents in Bethlehem. And so when Herod found out that the Messiah was born in Bethlehem, he went and sent people to kill all of those young males 2 years and under. Why is there no extra biblical recording of the massacre of the innocents in Bethlehem? So many of these events that we do have extra biblical evidence, you might say. Why would there not be any? Because it's not recorded anywhere else. And that's a question that people will challenge you, maybe not you personally, but challenge us on when it comes to the Bible stories. You know, if there was such a massacre of this, why isn't it recorded anywhere in history? Josephus was one of the historians. We'll talk about him a little bit more next week. But Josephus was very important. He was a historian in that day and recorded a lot of events and a lot of what we know about New Testament sites, including Jerusalem and other cities and events that happened. We go to Josephus because he elaborates quite a bit. But he never mentions this, nor does anybody else. Well, Bethlehem, you have to remember, was a small town. So if you ever hear this challenge, why is it not recorded anywhere else, this event where, you know, innocents were slaughtered? It's because it was a small town. And they figure it might only have been, all told, maybe 20 or 30 young children that would have at most been slaughtered. So it probably didn't make a lot of news. So that's just part of the story there. As we introduced Herod to you, and the type of person that he was. Of course, it starts with the massacre of the innocents. And so we're going to continue on today and talk a little bit more about Herod the Great's rule over Israel. Does anybody know where the home palace of Herod the Great was at the time? It's in the notes. Pastor Dorn. No. He did have a palace there. He had a winter palace there. But his home palace was in Caesarea Maritima. And he built that up. And we're going to begin with that pretty much. But I do want to read just a little blurb that I had copied. It's not in your notes, but just for our benefit to get a little bit better feel for who Herod the Great was, type of person that he was, and then you can infer from that how the Israelites or the Jews may have felt in that context, living and growing up under Herod the Great. So Herod the Great, not to be confused with Herod Antipas, who came later, is one of the most important characters in Jewish history. He was ambitious, cruel, and paranoid, to be sure, but nevertheless he remains a very significant person in the terms of understanding this period of Roman domination of the Jewish people. Herod's first leadership role was as governor of the Galilee, a position granted to him by his father Antipater. Early on in his career, he demonstrates his brutality by ruthlessly crushing a revolt in the Galilee. Also, he ended up killing two of his sons and one of his wives. It's the type of man he was. Very paranoid, and as we already have seen, not unwilling to murder at the drop of a hat, so to speak. The background to Herod's rise to power is the Roman Civil War that will transform Rome from a republic into an empire ruled by the Caesars, or the emperors. So in 44 BC, Julius Caesar is murdered by Brutus and Cassius, who are in turn defeated by Antony and Octavian in 42. The Battle of Actium in 31 is the final showdown between Octavian and Antony. Octavian emerged as the unrivaled victor, changing his name to Augustus and becoming the first Roman emperor. So that's Augustus Caesar. Herod had originally sided with Antony, but switched allegiance at the last minute and backs Octavian. His last-minute support for Octavian earns him Augustus' confirmation and title as King of Israel. Herod will reigned as king of Israel, Judah, from 37 BC until his death in about 4 BC, a long reign of 33 years, and in many ways a good period in terms of development of the country and social stability. So that was one thing that he did provide for the country. Part of the reason for the stability was that during this time, the Romans mostly took a backseat role in the day-to-day life of the Jews. The general Roman attitude was one of tolerance, meaning Jews were granted exemptions from the official Roman state religion. A very interesting point to remember is that religion and state went together in all empires in the ancient world, and more so in Rome than almost anywhere else, because Rome also practiced emperor worship. And that is, the Romans deified their emperors posthumously, as soon as they died. So linking state and religion gave the rulers added legitimacy. The connection between temporal power and spiritual power gave them complete control over the physical existence and spiritual existence of their subjects. While accepting the state religion was a vital part of Roman identity and loyalty to the state, the Romans were also pragmatists. They had learned by the Greek experience, and there were many rebellions of the Jews, and they continued even through the Roman period, if you look at history. So while the Romans had this system of even emperor worship, linking religion to government, they were pragmatists. They knew by experience that the Jews now could not be forced to worship idols. Okay, so this ties in with when the Jews came back from captivity. No longer did we have to worry about them worshiping pagan idols, because now they had gotten it. The Lord God, the Lord is their God. He is one. And so the Romans knew this. So they knew that the Jews were not like the other pagan peoples. They were not going to conform. So the Romans granted the Jews an official status of being exempt from the Roman state religion. And on the one hand, it was very smart and a very tolerant policy. On the other hand, with that policy also went a punitive tax specifically for the Jews called Fiscus Judaicus. And as you read through the New Testament, taxation is one of the themes of oppression from the Romans. And so this is why they were taxed so heavily, because they were basically buying their freedom to practice their religion. So you want to be exempt from state religion? Okay, so long as you pay for the privilege. It might have happened that the Jews simply just paid the tax and did their own thing, but we know it didn't go that smoothly, as you can see throughout history and in the New Testament. So that explains a little bit about Herod's interaction and relationship with the Jews at the time. So now we want to go on, and we're going to take a look at two sites, I think, we'll get to, that illustrate Herod's, just his power and his reign over Israel, reinforcing this whole idea that the Jews are in their homeland, but they're still in exile. It's not their homeland. Okay, the Romans are exercising such great control. And so we're going to go to the home palace of Herod the Great, which is along the Mediterranean Sea. I think this might even actually be a little video. It's not very long, but that's a shot of the Mediterranean Sea. And what you're looking at are remnants of where Herod's palace stood. In Caesarea Maritima, which means, Herod built this city. It was a port city. There's no natural port city along the coast of Israel. Just the way the currents go, it continually brings in silt. And so the coast, there's no deep water really available naturally. So they would have to carve out a coast and make it a man-made place for a harbor. And Joppa was one such place, almost straight across from Jerusalem. But Herod wanted a special place to dedicate to the Caesar Augustus. So he made this town and honored him by naming it after Caesar, which was kind of common. And you heard the politics there. And so he made a port city, called it Caesarea by the Sea, Maritima. And so that's what this is. And just a little bit better view of relationship where this is. Jerusalem. Over here is Joppa. And here's where Herod the Great builds Caesarea Maritima. So this is what the site looks like now from the air. And I just wanted to explain just a few things to point out. This was a very large port city, And with all of the Roman accoutrements that came along with whenever they built any Roman city, maybe even more so. This was one of Herod's prize. And, of course, this is where he resided whenever things were calm in Israel. He would go home to his palace and stay here. But he would certainly have to visit his other places. So you can see down here is the theater. It was a very large theater. I think it seats 3,500 people, which was quite large for back in that day. And over here is his palace system. And we'll take a look at this a little bit closer. But his palace, his courtyards, and he had, as Herod always did, a swimming pool, an outdoor swimming pool that was out, jutting out into the ocean. And then you see another arena here. This is called a hippodrome. And it's a very, very, very large arena for his games and entertainment. And this is specifically designed for horse racing and chariot racing. And you'll get to see that a little bit closer. And then further down here, this is the remnants of what's left over of the harbor. And then this territory all out through here was the town. It kind of radiated out, the streets radiated out here, and the town, the residents, all kind of served to supply Herod the Great when he was in town. So we visited Caesarea Maritima, and you'll just get a chance to look at some pictures of what's left there. And you remember this place, as many other places, has been destroyed or left go either by wars. Of course, the Muslims came through here and took it over at one point, rebuilt things. Then the Crusaders came through here and tore down and rebuilt things. But we still have lots of remnants of what's left over from the Roman era as well. So here we're entering in, as people would have back 2,000 years ago, into the arena, going through the tunnels. And this is the arena. We will come back to this arena because it has a very neat story to it later on with another Herod, Herod Agrippa. But this is, for now, just so you know, this is where the king would have sat. That was his box. To watch any of the entertainment. And this is in very good condition, as you see. They still have concerts and activities that go on here. Back in the day, I'm told that these seats would have been covered with animal skin, vellum, and people that would have been attending would have brought their own little bit of a cushion to sit there and watch the show. So kind of very sophisticated, a beautiful view. And for later purposes, I just wanted you to take note the orientation of this. Which direction is this theater facing? Facing west, exactly. So that comes into play in a story later on, which we'll get to either next week or the next. Okay, so it's a beautiful, beautiful sight, just to be able to walk through there and see how it was, some of the remnants. One of the few sites that I don't think our group sang here, but every time they got to a theater, there were too many people here. It's a very popular site, I think. But every site that was a theater, the group sang. Again, not me. I took pictures. All right, so this is a reconstruction picture. There you see the theater and how nicely it would have been built with actually a covering over the top to provide shade. Spared no expense, Herod the Great did, when he did his building. He was one of the best builders of his time. And so this would have been his palace system. And here you can see the hippodrome. And we're going to move into that in a bit. But these would have been some official buildings, some courtyards, where he conducted business, and then this would be his outdoor palace, outdoor swimming pool, and you saw remnants of that in an earlier picture that he built out onto a promontory into the ocean and had his palace there. just a sign to remind me what the history of the compound is, going through the different... They had underground water system and sewage system here. I think that looks like a well. Okay, so there you can get maybe a better picture of some of what's left of the courtyard. And out here was this outdoor swimming pool area. And you can see this kind of odd-shaped rock here. This is not rock. I think that is concrete. And you see more of it over in the harbor. And that was an invention of the Romans. They discovered how to make concrete or hydraulic cement. So they mixed. And I have some details here if we get a chance to read and time about how they did that. Pretty amazing, the technology that they had at this time. And I don't know about you. This is one of my impressions. Go back to my impressions. Is that you go back 2,000 years ago, and I'm reading the Bible stories, and I'm thinking, this is a very crude, barbaric, simplistic way of life. But really, as the Romans come in here, the Greeks have already come through. Life in many ways was fairly sophisticated when Jesus arrived on the scene. And that just was one of the impressions that I took home with me. Actually, having observed, you know, the Roman architecture and Greek architecture and art and things that were there. And of course, these are mosaic stones inlaid to provide, again, that's their artwork. And I have some samples up here of things that we brought from both Caesarea and the next place that we visited. And you can see we even picked off some of the mosaic stones that they would have used. These were laying loose, so we didn't feel too guilty about taking them. But one of the interesting things here, this came from Caesarea Maritima by the sea, and it's a rock that has a hole going through it. Anybody guess what that might have been? Yeah, so I think this was a weight that they used for their fishing nets. They would have used nets, and I actually looked this up on the internet, and they had a lot of these, and I think Heather was the one that found this. So this was probably a weight for a fishing net that they would have used along the coast there as they did their fishing. All right, another picture. Any questions at this point? Just going to show you some pictures and let you kind of soak in the scenery.
Do you have any pictures of how he built the harbor, because it had to do it a certain way for protection of the ships once they got in because of the way the wind
was? Yeah, I do have a reconstruction, and we'll see the harbor and then a picture of how it was constructed, yeah.
I read that whole book of Jim Jesus, and he really talks in detail about all this stuff.
Oh, very good. Yep. Josephus, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. Josephus was very, that was another impression. I didn't know much about Josephus at all going over there. But man, as you hear about these places and people, you know, the tour guides and whoever, the professors who were talking, they were constantly mentioning Josephus. So Josephus was a person that we benefit greatly from when it comes to understanding the context of New Testament. So here's some remnants of the pillars of his palace. And this was known as the courtyard. We'll come back to this in a later point, because probably this is where Paul stood on these very stones when he was on trial and he appealed to Caesar before Herod Agrippa II and Felix and Festus. So this would have been the municipal courtyards. And now we're heading over into the Hippodrome, where the chariot races would have taken place. And as you entered into the Hippodrome, we all got a kick out of this. Anybody guess what this is? These are the public latrines. Yep. So as you entered in and you had to use the restroom, here you are. You sat between two of these stones. There would have been running water going through here. Did your business? I don't see toilet paper rolls anywhere. It's why you never shake, even to this day, it's an offense to shake somebody's hand with your left hand. I'll leave it at that. Yeah, they would have had, I think, curtains in front of this, but still. Yeah, not as sophisticated quite yet as we are when it comes to that. So this is the inside of the Hippodrome. A very interesting area. Of course, this would be the grandstands for the VIPs and the nobility. But you can see all these stones. This held quite a large number. This held thousands, I think up to maybe 10,000 people, this arena would have held. So no small potatoes, this guy Herod the Great. And these were just illustrating the starting gates for the chariot races. Some of the stables, I believe. I think a lot of this, yeah, it when they found it and uncovered it, you know, the walls would have been falling over, and they did rebuild a lot of the walls. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I wanted to say something more about what's left over. So, yeah, they would have rebuilt some of these where they have fallen over. And sometimes when these places were excavated, maybe, 50, 60, 70 years ago, people came through here and did initial excavations. They weren't very careful, and they would have found the walls standing, but they left them exposed, and then they fell over. But they took pictures, so then some of these are reconstructed based on the pictures that were taken. But if they could reconstruct them, they would, to a certain point anyway, using what was there. Some of them they found standing, so some of them they would reconstruct. Somebody had asked the question, in these older cities that are built civilization upon civilization, whenever all of these big stones are pushed over and destroyed, you know, how do you build on top of that? Because you just have a mess of stuff. Well, don't forget, and I didn't share this, but the upper part of a lot of the buildings was made out of mud brick. So we are looking at the foundation stones and walls and the big structures that would have been built, and they would have lasted and stayed for quite some time. But the upper structures, the houses and all of that, would have been made of mud brick. And so when that was destroyed, that basically turns, when it's exposed to rain over time, to dirt. And so that's how things could fill in, and they could flatten everything out to start a new civilization. And that's what we saw at a lot of these places, is that type of soil was always all red. At least I think it was red. And that was probably what it was. So anyhow, a little bit of archaeology there. It had rained, as you can see, and so the Hippodrome had filled in a little bit with water from different places, but you can still see a good bit of the remnant of the Hippodrome looking long ways. Quite a big structure. These were some of the storehouses for the king and the palace. They would have stored their goods in here. And of course, they would have had to have their Roman bath system. This would have been the public Roman bath system. You can tell by the marble that is brought in, imported in, overlaid on the stone. And of course, all of this would have been covered, and you would have had your whole system of the frigidarium, the tepidarium, the caldarium, and all of these different stages of taking care of the body, and even lecture halls in here for the health of the mind. So they had an entire system, the Romans did, of treating the body and mind. And so here we're walking, I guess, north towards where the ancient harbor was, and it's pretty well built up. I think there's, of course, a modern building, but the Crusaders had built this up as well as did the Muslims. And so this is the picture that gets to the harbor and what it looked like back in the day. And so, yes, this is where they would have had to, and I did a little more reading as well, they had to construct wooden boxes and let them down into the water, and then they added all of this mixture of concrete, limestone, ash, and all of that to make this hydraulic cement. And so, yeah, they had to build a harbor and protect it from the waves. And, of course, here would be the inlet and a lighthouse even, but an inlet so that the ships would be protected. It could unload and reload. And, of course, the busy town in the back and to support all of what was going on. You can see another stadium over here, another arena back in here, in addition to the Hippodrome. This was huge stuff. And so this was Herod the Great and what he had done. I guess I'll just read a little paragraph here. I think I have some time. About the harbor, Sebastus Harbor, which Sebastus means Augustus, was built by Herod the Great, largest artificial harbor built in the open sea, enclosing around 100,000 square meters. He built two jetties, dedicated it to Caesar, Sebastus. The pace of construction was impressive, considering the size and complexity. The breakwaters were made of lime and pozzolana, a type of volcanic ash set into underwater concrete. Herod imported over 24,000 square meters of this ash from Puzzuoli, which would have been Italy, to construct the two breakwaters, the 500-meter long on the south and 275 meters long on the north. So this is a longer one down here. I guess maybe that's where the waves came from mostly. A shipment of this size would have required at least 44 shiploads of 400 tons each. And Herod also had 12,000 square meters, cubic meters, of Kirkur quarter quarried to make rubble. I guess that's some kind of stone. And 12,000 cubic meters of slaked lime mixed with the pozzolana. So, anyhow, that's some of the technology that went into building the harbor there and what is left. It wasn't of the same quality that they built in Rome, so that's why it is degraded to the extent it has. For some reason, this concrete didn't stick to the stone that was found in the Mediterranean at this spot as well as it did in Italy. So there was a bit of technology transfer that didn't work as well. Quite impressive for the day. This is just a sarcophagus that was kind of sitting out in the middle of nowhere, but interesting. And actually, I think this is Herod's. You might have already seen this. This is Herod's sarcophagus, which was supposed to be in Herodium, which we talked about last week. But it was smashed to bits when they found it, but it's restored, and now it's in the Israel Museum. And that's just to show you, again, you might have seen this already, the Roman aqueduct that fed Caesarea Maritima. So not only did he build this huge city, he had to have fresh water, and so that was 10 miles to the north at Mount Carmel. And so he built the Roman aqueduct. And again, you talk about engineering, this was a 1-degree slope for 10 miles, maintained all the way down to Caesarea. Okay, we're going to move on from the coast. Anybody have any questions at this point? It says, my little blurb here said, between 22 and 15 BC. So what's that, 7 years it took? Yeah. It was amazing the pace that he did build. I would think that would have taken decades, but no. They had the technology, and, of course, he had access to the manpower and finances, and so that's what he did. And he did this all over Israel. And that's kind of what I'm trying to impress you with is how this Herod the Great's architecture and building all over Israel kind of sent the message of Roman power to the Israel, to the Jews. So we're going to go from Caesarea Maritima here down to the south now to a place near the bottom of the Dead Sea, and it's very dry in here, and it's called Masada. You may have heard of Masada. There's lots of documentaries about it. It doesn't have a whole lot to do with New Testament context, except that, again, this is Herod the Great, one of his great building projects, again, to project his power over the Jewish nation. And so this is his southern desert fortress. And as you're down at the Dead Sea, we were further south and we're driving north. And this is what you see as you take pictures out the window of the bus. These high plateaus in the desert area. And as you come along, you get to one particular plateau that's kind of isolated all the way around. And Herod takes notice of this, and he builds a fortress on top of it. And this is called Masada. And Masada, I believe, is a word for fortress. Whoops. So this is a picture from the air. I did not take this, of course. But here on the back of this plateau would have been all of his gardens and residences to take care of this. Now, mind, he didn't spend much time here. And yet this was an entire city almost built on top of here. And how did they get it all up here? Well, you know, the point is it's inaccessible. It's a fortress. So it's very difficult to get it up, everything that was required. But he built also two palaces here as well, and a playground. Again, he had to have his outdoor swimming pool, and I think that's what that was, and a palace here and an upper palace here. Great views, and I think, I won't say for sure, but I think he used this in the summer from time to time because there was good air current, and it was. Of course, this was built for him because he was so paranoid and wanted to keep his power. If he was ever threatened, he could take he and his family down here to this fortress. And they could survive years up on top of this. He brought soil for gardens up there. So he had years' worth of food and water, actually, up. And it doesn't rain down here except for once or twice a year. There's a more impressive. So this is a huge tourist attraction. It's just a beautiful area. I think this is from the other side, from the back side, so you can see how inaccessible this place is, his desert fortress. And here's a model of it, again, to impress you with just the magnificence of what Herod could do. There you can see these palaces a little bit better, the construction of things up on top. No, this is just a model here, but it does not snow down here. This is 1,400 feet below sea level in the south of Israel, and I don't think they get snow. Well, it took us a long time because this was the one time that they had rain down in this area. And so when they have rain down, we actually were up north of the Dead Sea, I'm thinking somewhere along the Jordan River up by the Sea of Galilee. And the day we came down, traveling down here to our hotel along the Dead Sea, it would normally have taken us, I think, 45 minutes. But it took us 3 hours because we had to go around Jerusalem and come down. So normally, I think probably 45 minutes. No. And so this is us, I should say, these people down here. Heather walked to the top of Masada. That's kind of one of the things. Did you walk to the top of Masada? I did not. You can see there's wires here. I took the cable car. I got a better view, I think, but an easier ride. But do you know the story of Masada? So just briefly to tell you the story of Masada and where it gets importance. It was used by Herod the Great. It's a great tourist attraction, great structure. Didn't really play too much of a part in the Jewish life or New Testament times, but it did. It's a great... one of the greatest symbols for the Jewish people of this day is Masada. And the reason is because when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem and came in and destroyed the temple, the Jews fled. Some of them fled to Masada. About 1,000 of the zealots fled to Masada, thinking that the Romans had forgotten all about this place and they were going to come down here and hide out until the dust settled. Well, Romans, you know, this is Roman military ideology. They're going to wipe this out, this whole insurrection, because the Jews had rebelled and the Romans were going to put it down. They destroy the temple, destroy Jerusalem, and now they're going to wipe out as many of these rebels as they can. And they heard about this group that went down to Masada. And so down marched the Roman military to Masada. Of course, it's a fortress. They can't get up. There's no way they can get up there. And these rebels have years' worth of food and supply. They have water to last them for as long as they need. So what do the Romans do? They start building a siege ramp up on top of this huge plateau, towards this plateau. And so they build the siege ramp, and it takes them months and months and months, and there's many, many divisions of Romans camped all around Masada, taking turns doing this, and they finally are successful. And they go up, and once they arrive there, they find out that all of these rebels have committed suicide. So they don't have, after all of this time, they've been denied the pleasure of putting these rebels to death. They've all committed suicide. And so to the Israelis today, this serves as a huge symbol to them that the theme is, never again will we be put in this situation. Okay, so they're not going to be ever put in a position where they're going to have to hide out. They're going to fight before this happens. And so I'll just read you just a little bit here about this. Start where they talk about, they used a lottery system. The men killed their wives and children, then each other, until the last survivor killed himself. According to historian Flavius Josephus' account, the Romans advanced but found only an awful solitude and flames within in silence, and they were at loss to conjecture what happened. Here, encountering the massive slain, instead of exulting over as their enemies, they admired the nobility of their resolve. And Josephus recorded that 2 women and 3 children survived to tell the tale. And in your notes, I left, this is the tradition that even today, it's mostly special forces, but a segment of the Israeli Defense Forces, they take their oath of loyalty to the Jewish state on top of Masada. And so they will, at night, take a Bible, a Hebrew Bible, and a gun, and they will walk up to Masada. They do their ceremony, and at the end they say, Masada shall never fall again. Never again. And they yell that together. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of the mindset of the Israeli Defense Forces as they look at the threats around them. This is never going to happen to them again. And others get inducted at the Western Wall, at one of the other sacred places. And it was interesting, as we went around to these places, we saw groups of Israeli Defense Forces. And I think these were new troops, but they were in groups at these historic sites. They were all learning about their history. And every Israeli person must go through this. And so that's their mindset now. So that's the history of Masada. We'll see a little bit more of the pictures here. That's the view from up on top, looking out north towards the Dead Sea. And you can see the walkways out there that you could get to Herod's remnants of his palaces. We didn't have time to go out there. There's just not enough time, even when you get to one of these sites, to do everything and see everything. Again, another shot of the view. Very beautiful area overlooking the Jordan Valley and the Salt Sea. View up on top. Nothing can grow there. So the only thing, when he had gardens, and I'll show you here in a bit, so this is looking back to the west. Yeah, that's what you get. It's all dry. And so now, there you see the remnants of one of these military encampments dating back to 70 A.D. And there are a number of those. I don't know if I have pictures there. You can see one in the distance out there. Outlined. So there had these camps all over surrounding Masada. Now there's a little bit closer shot of it. And there's the siege ramp, what's left of it. And now we're standing at the top of Masada looking down, and that's quite a massive amount of earth that they've moved in there by hand. And a lot of it, okay, over 2,000 years has eroded away, but to see there's still quite a bit of it there. We actually were able to stand at the place at the top where they broke through. This is probably it right here where they broke in. Some of the remnants of the buildings up on top. So they had a synagogue up there. The Romans would have converted maybe some of the places or built their own at some point in time. The Jews would have, I should say. So there was remnants of a synagogue there and a mikveh where they would have done their ritual cleansing. And you can see they had to plaster it so it would hold water. I'm not sure how they got living water up there, though. And this is the remnants of that synagogue, so we had a little bit of a devotional in there, in the old synagogue on top. And of course I brought rocks and things and some pottery from both Caesarea Maritima and Masada. Plenty of rocks to take a bit. Now I show this to tell you that just along these, how did they get water up there? Well, Herod had gutters carved into the banks all along here to channel water for the two or three times a year that it did rain. He would channel the water, catch it, and towards this direction and pool it in different places and then have to carry it up by donkey and then fill the big cisterns. Okay, there's a channel way that was still visible. And he would fill the big cisterns that were in underground under Masada. So that's how they could gather enough water. And there's a picture of a cistern. I don't think it has water in it. One more shot of the siege ramp. Okay, last shot. Heather on top of Masada, looking out over the Jordan Valley and the Dead Sea. Any questions? That's where I'm going to stop it there. Yes?
So Caesarea is not a city?
No, it's a tourist attraction. That's about all there is to it right now.
That was a big city back then.
Yes. Pretty much. Yeah, there's just nothing. Now, you know, some of the cities that we didn't get to a lot of Old Testament cities. There would still be cities around there. But yeah. Yeah, as technology came along, and we'll talk a little bit more about this, I guess, as, you know, through the Middle Ages and whatnot, these places were destroyed, taken over by the Arabs, and, you know, the cities weren't appreciated, and they certainly weren't. Civilization wasn't. I mean, it was much more sophisticated in the Roman era than it was through the Middle Ages. Say that. They didn't worry about developing these cities, I think, too much. And in the modern day, they're tourist sites, and so they don't want to develop around it. and once you start building anywhere, you're going to find something, and they'll put a halt to it. So they build cities where there's no archaeological site. Yes. Certainly one more point of tension, and that's what you get over there, 1,000 points of tension between, yes. I'll just end with this, and it's the second point that's in your notes there. The first point I talked about last week, second point, things that I tried to, what do I learn from the context of this Roman oppression of the Israeli people? Roman rule was a cause for constant discontent of the Jews, as Doran just gave us an illustration. Jesus never once, though, encouraged his disciples to engage in a violent military fight against an earthly kingdom. And that's one of the take-homes I came home with, is that, being immersed with all of this Roman oppression, what did Jesus advocate? He didn't advocate a rebellion. He had plenty of opportunities to do that, but he did not. So I will leave it there, and let's just close in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for, again, our time together. Pray that you would continue to grant us a good time of worship here to follow. And may your name be glorified and praised, and as we worship you, in Jesus' name, amen.